Are mothers supposed to be vending machines? Because that's sure what it feels like. You put in the right coin and immediately get whatever response you want. And if you don't, you get to punish them. I am tired of the impossible expectations. It is literally not possible to be a perfect mother in this culture, or even really to be considered a good mother. Meanwhile, my ex-husband gets praised for producing the sperm to make our children and occasionally showing up and not beating them in front of everyone. I love my kids. I love being a mother. I hate the institution of motherhood. Hi, I'm Zonva Lyons, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. As always, I'm going to ask you to help support this podcast by sharing it on social media, by leaving positive reviews on your favorite podcast platform, by heart reacting it on Substack, and by leaving comments, sharing, otherwise engaging. As you probably know by now, because I'm constantly talking about it, social media algorithms are trying to drive away feminist and leftist creators. They are very punitive with us. And the most effective way to push back against that is not to boycott social media, but actually to give the algorithm what it wants, which is engagement. So the more you engage with my work and with the work of other creators you love, the more work they can do and the more visible their work becomes. You can also sign up to become a paid subscriber. Paid subscribers get at least one bonus podcast episode a month. All of these actions to promote the podcast really do help, and paid subscribers are the sole reason I am able to do this work. So your support and promotion really, really matters. I will never accept advertiser money. I will not allow this work to be censored. And that means I am solely dependent on you, my listeners. Thank you for being here. This month, October 2025, just in case you're listening sometime in the distant future, I am experimenting with a different model. I'm doing a podcast episode every week instead of my usual twice monthly schedule. I want to see if this pace feels sustainable, if podcast episodes still seem high quality, and if listeners like it, if you're able to listen to that many podcasts. So I'd love your feedback on whether I should keep up with this pace. Feedback also comes in the form of sharing, commenting, all of that. Increased visibility is feedback. So please let me know what you think. I am so excited about our guest today, Alex Bolin, because she can speak directly to the construction of the good mother and how it renders motherhood impossible, demoralizing, and just completely miserable in a patriarchy. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Zoran.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to tell listeners a little bit about you now. Alex Bolin is the author of Motherdom, Breaking Free from Bad Science and Good Mother Myths. She was a director of the research agency Ipsos and is now a freelance researcher. Alex is also a postnatal practitioner with the NCT, the UK's largest parenting charity, and has run groups for new mothers in London for over a decade. Motherdom is Alex's first book. She was inspired to write it because she felt incensed about all the guilt-inducing garbage which is peddled about motherhood. God, isn't that the truth? So, Alex, we're just going to get started. I love your book. I told you that before we started recording. It's such an amazing book that brings so many different strands of feminism and motherhood together. It really felt sometimes like you were in my head. And I know we both share an interest in the construction of motherhood and how patriarchy uses motherhood as a tool of women's oppression. I argue that I think it's one of patriarchy's primary tools. So tell listeners a little bit about your book and also a little bit about motherhood as a feminist issue and why it's just so important.
Yeah, thank you, Zorn. I'm so pleased to be speaking to you today. I've been so inspired by your work, and I think the way in which you write and think about motherhood really chimes with how I do. Motherhood and feminism, as I've sort of said in the book, they're symbiotic. There's more to motherhood than feminism. There's more to feminism than motherhood, but they are intertwined. And I think a really important reason for that is this spectre of the good mother haunts all women, not just mothers. And the good mother, who's supposed to be selfless and nurturing, puts everyone else before her, all women are expected to behave in that way, and are punished if they don't. I know, like me, you're a great admirer of Kate Manne's work. And when I read her work and she talked about women being givers and men takers, it really just set off a light bulb in my head. I was like, yeah, that's it. That's what the institution of motherhood is. It posits women as giving, without any regard for them or their needs, and men as taking. So I think tackling the institution of motherhood should be a central plank of feminism. And like you, it makes me quite dismayed when we see motherhood being marginalised from sort of broader feminist struggles.
So I think often about this myth of the good mother, and I think that sometimes when I talk about the myth of the good mother, or when you do, or when anyone does, people kind of get their backs up against the wall because they're like, oh, whoa, these women are talking about how you shouldn't be a good mom, or you shouldn't follow research, or you shouldn't follow science. But that's not really it. What this construction is really about is that no matter how you mother, someone is going to criticize it. Someone is going to say it's wrong. And in patriarchy, the very worst thing you can be is a bad mother. And all mothers are eventually constructed by someone as a bad mother. Tell me how that like controls us and keeps us in line and just keeps us feeling guilty and second guessing ourselves and just endlessly working.
Yeah, endlessly working. Well, I think it's through what I call good mother myths. And these good mother myths can be very broad. You know, the good mother is self-sacrificing, the good mother puts herself first, the good mother wants to be with her children all the time. Or they can be very narrow. For instance, you know, the good mother stares into her baby's eyes when she's breastfeeding. These good mother myths are myths. They're not based on what it means to be a good mother. And that's why they're so harmful, I think. I'm interested in sort of unpicking what's beneath them. So, for instance, I've just written about Trump's recent kind of linking autism and Tylenol. So, why are people even saying that? What's that all about? Well, I think that's about policing pregnant bodies. It's about trying to persuade women that they shouldn't be putting things into their bodies like contraceptive pills. So it's chipping away at reproductive justice. It's about underpinning a sort of natural view of motherhood, which then feeds into sort of rigid gender roles. So I think we need to understand what these good mother myths are, who is using them, who's exploiting them, and why. And I think a really important part of that is to understand, well, what is the evidence behind this? Why are people saying this? Is there anything to this? Because I think we all want to be good mothers. And that's where the power of good mother myths come from, because we want to be good mothers. We care about our children. And so if someone says to you, you're going to harm your child if you do this, you're going to harm your child if you don't do that, you're going to hurt your child if you feel this way, or if you go to work, or if you do this, or all sorts of things. And because we love our children so much, that gives these good mother myths such power. And that's one of the things which makes me so angry about them, because they trade on women's love for their children.
So one of the wildest things that happened to me in early motherhood with my oldest daughter was she was a newborn, like less than a week old. And we had one of those like baby mats that has all the toys hanging from it that they can, you know, whack at and look at and all of that. And we put her on it, but because she was a newborn, she couldn't grab anything and really had no idea what was going on. So we started like pulling the toys down and showing them to her because, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. You teach them things. And one of the toys was a little mirror. So my husband pulled the mirror down and like held it in front of her face. And I took a picture of her looking into the mirror because she just like looked cute, just cute picture, totally uninteresting. And then I posted on Facebook and my cousin's father-in-law wrote like 3,000 words about all you women are just staring into your image, and that baby doesn't even understand what a mirror means. And by the way, you need to put down your phone and stop taking pictures and look her in the eyes. And it was just wild. Like I just thought I was being a good mom playing with my baby. I'm like, we've checked all the boxes. We're playing with her together. We're taking cute pictures. We're doing like And this dude's writing 3,000 words about what a terrible parent I am, and he's also citing quote unquote science. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about kind of this fake science. You know, the Tylenol is an example of that, but there's so much of it where there's this like one study that shows this one thing might have a modest effect, and then suddenly everybody latches onto it, and it's just another way to control what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, my jaw was dropping as you were just telling me that story. And I think it's such a good example of the fact that mothers can do nothing right. You're always going to be found at fault. And I think, and I've written about this a lot in the book, science is one of the pillars of good mother myths. And because science has authority. And it's quite interesting with the sort of Make America Healthy Again movement, although it's kind of based on, scare quotes, everything being natural, they are still invoking science to justify their arguments, like with the Tylenol piece. So yes, so science is taken out of context. Sort of small studies which haven't been replicated are treated as if they're gospel, basically. If you must do this otherwise. And I've written about it quite a lot in the book, but attachment theory, I mean, to put it in its crudest terms, insensitive mothers screw their babies up. So you're supposed to be really sensitive to your baby, you're supposed to interact with them all the time, and if you don't, they're going to grow up to be unhappy. Now, I'm exaggerating a bit, but that is essentially what is sort of out there in the ether. And if you sort of look at the research base and the evidence base, it just doesn't say that at all. And what's quite interesting about attachment research is the people who actually do attachment research have really distanced themselves from these kind of popular interpretations of it. But it is still used to sort of hit mothers over the head. I think that's a really sort of well-known example. Another thing which I've written about in the book is neuroscience and the idea that we sort of need to build our children's brains. And again, the science that is based on is so flimsy. There's so much about the human brain we still don't know. And so the idea that you need to interact with a baby or a child in a certain way to sort of build their brain is just nonsense. It really is nonsense. But it causes so much guilt and doubt amongst parents, which is just completely unacceptable.
The attachment parenting thing, I want to talk about that a little bit because I went hard on attachment parenting. And I did it knowing that it wasn't entirely scientific and also wasn't the only way to parent. It just sort of aligned with my parenting values. And so I want to kind of point out that, like, anytime you hear us criticizing a particular parenting style, it doesn't mean that parenting style is bad. It doesn't, it doesn't mean it's a wrong way to parent. It just means there's a more expansive view. But what I saw with the attachment parenting is I was in all these attachment parenting groups, and over time, a theme emerged that there actually wasn't that much discussion of here's how you emotionally connect to your baby, here's how you understand your baby's needs. There were instead two other focuses. One was on aesthetics. How do you show people you're an attachment parent? What's the right way to wear your baby? What's the right way to sleep with your baby? Because people have to see you doing this. And so that means you're spending money, you're feeding capitalism, and you're doing this like really intensive performative parenting. And the other, even darker thing I saw was this notion that mothers must never be away from their babies, and they certainly must never work. And to me, that seems like the real reason that in a world where like 80% of mothers do work, attachment parenting has become so popular because it's a way to shame them. It's a way to make pretty much every mother a bad mother.
Yeah, 100%. And I think attachment parenting and that way of sort of parenting a baby just really works for some people. And I would never sort of judge or criticize someone for doing that. I think for some people, like you say, it really chimes with their values, with their family life, with their baby's personality. And I think, the agency of babies and children in how we parent is so important. And I think that often gets forgotten. But equally, as you rightly say, it's used as a stick to beat people with. So people will sort of say about attachment parenting that this is the biological norm, this is what we do, and this is the evolutionary norm, and babies aren't and children aren't supposed to be apart from their mothers. And that is just not true. I mean, it's a good mother myth that mothers have only recently started to work. Mothers have worked since the dawn of time. And this idea that mothers spend all their time at home on their own with a baby or a child, actually, that's not the norm. That's the weird thing. But I think because we want to be a good mother, a good parent, because that need and that drive is understandably so strong, we are really, really vulnerable to any kind of criticism. So what I sometimes see with attachment parents is wanting to ward off criticism and warding off criticism by then being critical of others and how they're parenting differently. And it means that no one wins. It also means it diverts our attention from who the real bad guy is here, which, as you say, is patriarchy.
And I think that's always it, is patriarchy. It's like the Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. It's always, how can we pit mothers against one another? How can we get women to fight for the few scraps patriarchy gives us, rather than looking at the horrible systems that we occupy? And also, why are we criticizing the mother who's spending, 12, 14, 18 hours a day with the baby, and not the lazy man sleeping in the next room? Doesn't he have to attachment parent too? And all of these systems target mothers. There's never anything that is like, here is the very intensive stuff that fathers have to do.
Yeah, 100%. And the standards to which mothers and fathers are held are so different. So a dad takes their kid to the park. He's a great dad. Okay, that is good parenting. Fabulous, well done. But whereas with the mother, anything a mother does wrong is fastened on. So all the many, many things that mothers do for their children are not acknowledged and not valued. And I think that's partly linked to the other pillar of good mother myths, which is this idea of mother as being natural. So we're just following our animal instincts. There's nothing clever or smart about what we're doing. We're just following our hormones or our urges or whatever. And it's so devaluing to the work of motherhood. And Dawn, you've written about this quite a bit, that motherhood is intelligent work. It's hard work. There aren't easy answers in a lot of cases for dilemmas we have about our children, for decisions we need to make, for situations that we're in. But we
Yeah,
don't recognize that. We don't value that.
it's so hard. I had this moment when I was really involved with like maternal activism long before I had kids, because my mom was really involved in that activism, and I thought it was interesting. I thought motherhood was interesting, and I wish that more people felt that way. But as a result of that, I had spent a lot of time around a lot of different mothers. And, I had spent a lot of time around some mothers that like I didn't necessarily like or respect. And I remember when I was in labor with my oldest child, it was like, a long labor, like first babies. And I remember I thought about one of the mothers that I knew who I didn't really like all that much, who had had like nine kids without any drugs. And here I was struggling to do it with just one. And I just thought, wow, like, maybe she's more impressive than I realize. Like, maybe she has some skills that I don't. And my journey in motherhood has just been a continuous process of being like, oh, this is really hard. Like, those women that I've judged before, they're actually really smart, because a lot of them are doing things that like are really hard for me.
Yeah, 100%. I really agree with that, because it's very easy to not see the labor and the thought and the emotion that can go into mothering. And I think particularly mothers living in poverty. So the amount of ingenuity and skill you need, if you have hardly any money to feed and clothe your kids, that's a different level of skill than if you've got a good income. And we should be giving those mothers enough money. But we should be applauding those women who are able to sort of bring their children up in really difficult circumstances. And what we actually do is good mother myths weigh even harder on those women. Bringing children up in an unequal, racist society and all the challenges that brings to those women's children, it's their fault. It's the good mother, they're not good mothers, scare quotes, and that's why their children have less chances and less opportunities than other children.
Yeah, Absolutely. My mom worked in child protective services for her whole life. And toward the end of her career, she was like the director of our local CPS organization. And I would go down and like volunteer with her. They would have events for like foster kids and stuff. And the thing that stuck out to me is that most of the kids who were in custody were actually not what you stereotypically expect. They weren't kids who were being sexually abused by their kid, the parents, or who had been, violently, physically abused or anything. They're kids whose parents were considered neglectful. And the thing that my mom said to me is like, what all of these parents need is money. And rather than giving them money, we're spending 10 times the amount they need on taking their kids and litigating taking their kids and, keeping their kids in custody. And it's just always stuck with me. Like, why can't we give them $20,000 rather than spending $150,000, fucking up the whole family?
Yeah, 100%. I think Dorothy Roberts has written about this brilliantly, and I sort of talked about this a bit in my book. I've talked about what I've called unmothering, which is a term I've borrowed from Black feminist scholars who use the phrase in the context of slavery. Central to the institution of slavery is the ripping of children from their families, but unmothering is a central pillar again in Good Mother Myths, because the threat of losing your children is one of the things which keeps people conforming to these myths. But some people do use their children, they have their children taken away. And okay, sometimes that is going to be the only solution, but it, in the UK, in the US, too many families lose their children because they're living in poverty. And what's classified as neglect is actually just being poor. And there's a Dorothy Roberts quote I've put in my book, exactly, as your mother was saying. It's like, we don't want parenting classes. We just want enough money to be able to feed and clothe our children. And I think for rich societies like the US and the UK, the fact that children go to sleep hungry, it should be a matter of huge national shame, but we seem to be okay with it.
Yeah, it's terrible. And here again, what we see is we take a political problem, which is exploitation and wealth inequality and all of that, and we pretend that it is an individual problem. We pretend, well, that mother didn't do a good enough job. She should have gotten this job and she should learn how to manage her money and all of that. But then what's so horrific in those instances is we don't even punish the mother, we punish the children with starvation and deprivation and poverty. And a large segment of the population is like, yeah, that's fine. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a report just came out, I think, yesterday from the National Academies, just looking at the impact of during the pandemic of sort of family support and the impact that had on child poverty. And it's not rocket science in terms of what kids need to sort of grow up in sort of financially secure way. It's money, and we make parenting so much harder than it should be because people grow up in poverty. And you have people growing up, children growing up in poverty whose mothers, fathers are working. So it's not like people aren't working, they're just not being paid very much because of the way in which our society is set up.
Yeah, it's so dark. One of the things that I find working with women is that patriarchy and white supremacy and capitalism and all of these hierarchical systems leave us all exhausted. It's just exhausting to be human. And the effect of that is that it tears down communities. And so women tend to really be isolated from other women. Lots of my readers tell me that they don't really have a single close friend, let alone like a network of women friends who can model mothering to them and help them out. And so women don't often know what other women's lives are like. And now, particularly with social media, there's this pressure to perform motherhood. So everybody is pretending that it's easy and pretending that they're great at it while they're falling apart behind closed doors. And what this means is that the people falling apart behind closed doors, which is basically all of us, think that it's an individual failing. They think that they're bad at it. But in reality, it's a political problem. And it begins with, I think, the separation of women. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the way in which motherhood is constructed is to make us look within ourselves instead of look, we sort of say, oh, we are failing, instead of saying, actually, we are being failed. And everything, I think, in a capitalist society is about making us focus on ourselves. It's like, oh, I just need to read this book or sign up to this course or buy this product, and then everything will be okay. And I think those communities of mothers, I'm really passionate about this. I see from my postnatal work, which is sort of groups of new mothers coming together, how transformative it is for women to talk about their problems and their issues. And to realize, hey, it's not me, it's just that this is hard. And also to realize that there aren't any sort of easy answers to some of the things that we struggle with. So, you have a baby who wakes up a lot in the night, and that happens to lots of people. There isn't a magic solution to that. There can be things you might try and they might work, but they might not work. So being able to sort of share those experiences with other people, I think, is really important. That's on the personal level. On the political level, I completely agree that we don't have those networks that we should have. And this is about the marginalization, to go back to what we were talking about earlier about sort of mothers' issues. It's like, oh, they don't really, those little fluffy issues around kind of childcare and schooling, and they don't really matter. Other things are more important. So that kind of marginalization of women's issues as well. So yeah, I think on a personal and a political level, having those communities, those networks, those conversations, those sharing of experiences is really important.
Oh my God, this depiction of mothers' issues as fluffy. This is a soapbox I've been getting on a lot lately, so I'm going to try not to have like a rage seizure while I'm talking to you about it. I get probably, I would say, at least twice a week a question from someone that's like, why don't you talk about current events? Why don't you talk about politics? And it's like, this is the future of humanity. Like this is a current event. And but we've just depoliticized everything pertaining to mothers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes back to the sort of the good mother who's almost like a kind of blank canvas. She's almost like a sort of cipher for her children, and she doesn't matter. She's a two-dimensional person. And the same about mother's issues as well. But you know what? Mother's issues are everyone's issues. As you say, it's about the next generation, but it's about the neighborhoods we live in, the houses we live in, the air we breathe, the food we eat. These are issues for everybody. And to try and sort of pigeonhole them as being, mother's issues, I think is just outrageous.
It's so frustrating. So you have an, I think, interesting anthropological, sociological perspective because you have spent a lot of time working with postpartum women and new mothers. What are you seeing on the ground that is not getting talked about or not being seen?
That's a really good question. And it's what's been interesting for me is it hasn't really changed, even though we have social media and more openness in inverted commas about mothers' issues. But people struggling with things, finding things difficult, not liking being a mother, finding it challenging looking after their babies. These are things which people are really frightened to admit. And it comes back to this fear that you will have your baby taken away. That's such a kind of powerful fear in the early days. And I don't think it ever goes away, but I think it's particularly acute in those early days and weeks where you're almost in a state of sort of hypervigilance. It's so new, this new role, this new person in your life is so new and can seem so vulnerable. I mean, a newborn is kind of almost like a sort of curled up little animal, and you don't necessarily have a sense of who they're going to be as a person, and you fear that you might break them or hurt them, and so the level of fear, of guilt, of shame, people, yeah, they don't talk about it nearly enough. And I think if you have a safe space, so like the postnatal groups that I do, people will open up, and it's such a relief to hear that other people are feeling similar things. And it doesn't mean, of course, if you're feeling this, it doesn't mean you don't love your babies. It's this idea that maternal love is this very sort of two-dimensional thing. It's like you either love your baby and love every moment with your baby, or you don't. It's kind of like, actually, it's a really complex, nuanced, rich relationship. And I don't think we give mother-children relationships enough credit for how rich they are and how they change and evolve as well.
Yeah, I think often about how I've been a lot of different mothers to like a lot of different children. And my kids are young, like they haven't even been here that long. And it just shifts constantly. But the shame and guilt bit, man, I remember when we had our first, there's this moment, and I think it's something a lot of new parents experience, where sort of the magnitude of it all hits you, that there's never going to be downtime like there was before, and there's never really going to be a reprieve from the responsibilities. But also there's like a longing to do trivial things. And my husband and I had this system because we like really had and have an equitable partnership, where in the very early days, we would each give each other like an hour a day to just do whatever. And like cooking and cleaning didn't count. It was like just go in the bedroom and, you know, read or sleep or whatever. And it was wonderful. But I started feeling like I needed more. Like an hour in a day was not enough. And I wanted to like sit down and like play with my planner and stickers, or like scroll the internet for like 3 hours. And I felt so guilty that like I wanted to do this. And but I have this baby, and why do I want to take time away from her? And you know, finally there was this like big dramatic confession of, you know, I really need 4 hours where I can cut pages for my planner and put stickers on them. And I know that's stupid, but that's what I want. And then my husband was like, well, okay, so why don't we do like an hour a day and like 4 hours a week? And then you'll be like an even better mom because you'll get to do the things that like your brain wants to do. And it was so wonderful, but it's also something that I think almost no new mothers get because they don't have partners who participate, and they don't have anybody to validate that like you're actually allowed to have a life outside of motherhood, and that that can make you a better mother.
Yeah, 100%. And I don't think it's stupid at all to want to do that. I mean, I think it's completely normal and completely understandable, but we don't allow the space for that. And you know, it's great that you have a supportive partner who's like, yeah, okay, let's do this. Let's make sure that this happens for you, because a lot of the time, as you say, people don't. And I think like 1 hour or 4 hours or you know, in a whole week is nothing. It's nothing. It's such a small amount of time. And it's exactly, you know, what I was saying earlier, that we just don't give ourselves credit. Instead of saying, I'm spending all this time with my baby and I'm doing all these things for my baby and with my baby, we're just like, oh, I feel really bad because I want to spend 1 hour or 4 hours doing something for me. And I think that is a really good example of, yeah, the good mother kind of beating us over the head. I always say to people, to new mothers, it's like, think about your red lines. Like, what are the things you need to do that's really going to make you feel like you? It's really important that you prioritize that and try and make time for that if you can. And, you know, if you can't pull in your partner to help, then maybe, you know, your mom or your friends. I remember I had one woman in one of my groups, and she just said, if I can make the bed in the morning, then I just feel okay. I feel like I'm kind of in control. And some people want to tidy up their kitchen or read or whatever it is, but it's just about being you and connecting back with you again, because the demands on your time and your energy when you're looking after a newborn or looking after a baby are huge. And of course, you need to look after yourself.
Yeah, talking about the need for self-care has me kind of wanting to circle back a little bit to how we weaponize science against mothers, because we always do this thing where we pit the needs of mothers against the needs of their babies and children and act as if mothers and children are natural enemies rather than, you know, the mother is almost always the primary caregiver and taking care of her means taking care of the child. I think, you know, even if the like fake science that we read were true, even if the ideal environment for a child was that they are never ever separated from their mother, like that's just one fact in isolation. There are other facts like, well, what's good for the mother? And then how does that influence the mother's ability to care for their child? But we never look at that, and we never look at, okay, is this thing that offers a tiny benefit to the child hugely to the detriment of the person who's caring for the child.
Yeah, I think 100%. And I think actually breastfeeding is quite a good example of that. I think breastfeeding is really important. It matters. And if a woman wants to breastfeed, then I think we should be supporting her. We should be encouraging her, making sure that she has what she needs to be able to do that. But equally, I don't think we should be pressurizing women to breastfeed either. And I think when you're sort of weighing up someone's mental health versus them trying to breastfeed it and not working out, or them having to sort of breastfeed a baby throughout the night and not getting any sleep, I think we have to take the mother into account. And that is partly for the baby. And people say happy mother, happy baby, and I agree with that. But it's also because the mother is still a person. She still matters. She matters in and of herself, not just because she's a mother. And for me, that is a really important thing for us to not lose sight of.
Yeah, I mean the breastfeeding, oh God, the breastfeeding is such a perfect example. So I'm probably a breastfeeding zealot in that I'm really supportive of breastfeeding and breastfeeding parents, but would never like push it on anybody. And in my own personal life, I have been continuously breastfeeding at least one baby for 8 years. Not breastfeeding one until they were 8 years old, but just having a baby who is breastfeeding. I'm currently nursing a toddler. And I think a lot of people do not understand how exhausting, demoralizing, and absolutely miserable breastfeeding can be when it's not easy and it's not going well, or when you're just unsupported, which most mothers are in a patriarchy. With our first child, I had terrible supply issues, and the things we did to increase my supply were insane. I was doing something breastfeeding related literally 24 hours a day. You wake up, four times a night, and you use the supplemental nursing system to like pump and nurse the baby, and it usually doesn't work, and the baby's screaming, and then you have to pump before and afterwards. And then by the time you've done that, the baby's back awake. I look back on that time and I truly don't know like how we survived. Like how we could live on like an hour of sleep, an hour of interrupted sleep every night for months and months and months while I try to get my supply up. I'm just like, God, why? Like, why?
Yeah, and I think so many of the contradictions about motherhood kind of reside in breastfeeding. And in terms of you're never able or to do anything right. And I think actually you wrote that brilliant piece you've written on kind of touches upon it. Is it Fuck You, Welcome to Motherhood? But it's
Yeah,
like,
welcome to motherhood, fuck you. Which is like, I want it on a shirt. Like that has
definitely.
been my experience of motherhood, is like, welcome, fuck you.
100%. And it's kind of like, you must breastfeed, but don't enjoy it and don't make a big deal out of it. But yeah, formula feed. And it's kind of like whatever you do, however you feed your baby, you will be criticized. And we sort of say, oh, breastfeeding is natural, as if to say it's going to be really straightforward. And it really often isn't. For most women in my experience, most breastfeeding parents, it is not straightforward. There's support needed. And I think one of the reasons for that is because breastfeeding is sort of shut away in our society. So we don't grow up watching babies being breastfed. So we don't really understand that actually they need to feed a lot and it's really common. And if they're feeding all the time, particularly when they're newborn, that's normal. We just don't, as a culture, we don't really understand breastfeeding. And that makes it so much harder for women who want to breastfeed.
I remember when I was in the hospital, they send the lactation consultant to, do whatever it is they do, lecture, guilt, shame. And they want you to keep a breastfeeding log, which is like an additional layer of labor. And the figure that they always give you is that babies should breastfeed 8 to 12 times a day. And it's like, that's how much mine was breastfeeding like at night. And I remember, calling my mom, crying and being like, there's something wrong with her. She needs to breastfeed 12 times a night. Like, what's wrong with her? And she was like, I am sorry that the lactation consultant sold you on this being easy. But no, that's common. it's like, oh, okay.
And actually with breastfeeding, like we treat people like idiots. It's like let's pretend that this is natural and easy and blissful, so they'll do it. And it's kind of like, no, let's just be honest about There are great things about doing it, and you'll have times when you might really enjoy it, and then you'll have other times when you feel really frustrated and claustrophobic. You know, it's a really, again, it's a kind of complex, rich experience, breastfeeding. And I think it's either portrayed as kind of like you're in this sort of Madonna-like state of bliss, or you're really miserable and your nipples are bleeding. And actually, there's lots of states in between those. And again, I think that's where having other people going through something similar is really helpful, because it's kind of like one day you might love breastfeeding and the next day you might find it really frustrating and think, oh God, I wish I could stop doing this. And that's just really normal. It's really understandable. It's such a commitment, I think, to another person, to feed another person. And we should recognize that that's a huge commitment.
Yeah, it really is. Well, and I see in my own breastfeeding journey how I've kind of experienced like every end of the stigma, which I think is true for like every mother, really. You know, it's like first you're trying to breastfeed and it's going poorly and it must be your fault. It must be because you're doing something wrong. And you know, now I'm breastfeeding a toddler and you know, that makes me a crazy person and I'm doing it for my own benefit. And you know, I'm definitely starting to feel that pressure to stop, even though we're at the point now where it's finally easy. So it's like once it's actually easy, well, then it has no value because the whole purpose of everything is for it to be hard.
And it's just like, and it's just nobody's business but yours and your child. And yeah, this idea, and I think this very sort of this squeamishness we have about bodies and breasts and wombs, I mean, I think it's all related to that as well. And again, you can never win.
No,
You
it's.
either don't breastfeed enough or you breastfeed for too long, you know, that you it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the most important thing for every mother to know about motherhood is that they're doing it wrong. And if they do the opposite, that's wrong too.
Exactly. And I think that's why having, you know, other women around you is really helpful, because you see, okay, they're doing it differently from me, but they are, I would say they are a good mother with a loving relationship with their child. I understand why they're doing things differently from me. And I think that's, you know, and this is a bit sort of pipe dreamy, but that is my ideal, that we sort of we look at what other people are doing without judgment, with curiosity and with compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were writing your book, was there anything that you learned or stumbled across that surprised you?
Such a good question. I don't think so, because I think it's sort of, as I dug into things, it sort of confirmed what I suspected. Yeah, so I don't think I was surprised by anything really. I think it was more, okay, right, this kind of, yeah, this kind of underlines what I thought about this. So no, so that's quite a boring answer, isn't it?
Well, it's not boring. I'm kind of glad that you didn't tell me that you actually stumbled across research that proved to you that feminism is not real and everything is mother's faults and we just need to accept what we're told by, I don't know, Donald Trump or whoever.
Yeah, I think what was interesting for me actually was particularly digging into the historical examples is how many echoes of what's happening now we see in the past. So this mother blaming has very long roots. It just shift it shape shifts according to the era we're in.
Yeah, well, it's like the, what was it, the refrigerator mothers with autistic children. I guess now it's the Tylenol mothers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just wrote a piece, the piece I just wrote about, and I've kind of speculated about whether or not Donald Trump, who was a boy and a young man, when this idea of the refrigerator mother was at its zenith. So the idea that children were autistic because their mother was cold and emotionless. Because it was really interesting how he fastened onto it, you know, and he kept going, if you can't tough it out, you know, he said that nine times, if you can't tough it out, you know. Don't take Tylenol. And so for me, that's a real echo of a previous good mother myth, kind of like, yeah, leaping up from the dead again. And here we go again. It's all mother's fault.
Well, and the tough it out language. I mean, that's kind of what we tell mothers for everything. And you know, the thing that everybody who has any sense knows is that the more resources you have, the easier it is to deal with something. I think childbirth is a really good example of, If you want to have an unmedicated birth, which a lot of women do, if you have a supportive partner and a doula and you're giving birth in a calm environment, whether it's, a hospital where they honor your wishes or a birth center or whatever, then it's going to be easier for you to tough it out because you have more things to draw on versus if someone's yelling at you and shaming you and your partner's telling you to shut up and you don't have any support. But what these right wingers want is they want us to tough it out while providing us with absolutely zero support. We're just supposed to, like, what is it we're supposed to draw on? Magic?
Yeah. And also you kind of just think, well, actually, is the tough up saying you deserve to suffer, because I think there's a really cruel streak in a lot of this discourse.
Absolutely. Kate Mann wrote an amazing piece about this a couple of weeks ago that the suffering is the point. And that's what they want because, if you're suffering as a woman, then you don't have the energy to do anything else.
Yeah. And it's the punish. And this is another thing which Kate sort of writes about brilliantly. It's like this idea of punishing women and just punishing us for being mothers, punishing us for not being mothers. We will just be punished, whatever we do.
We should have brought Kate Mann on this with us. And it's funny because I'm interviewing her later today about something completely unrelated. And now I'm just going to show up for the interview with like a bunch of questions about this. And she's going to be like, did you prepare? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think she writes with such clarity about all of this. It's, I think, I love your work and her work. I think, and actually, going back to what you were saying about not dealing with current events, I think all you need really as a feminist is your work and her work, because Kate does deal with, like she's written a couple of brilliant pieces about Charlie Kirk's death, for instance. So I think, yeah, I think that's all we need as a feminist, you and Kate, and I think we cover a whole gamut of what's going on in the world.
Well, that's very flattering, but I think we've got to bring you and some other people into the fold. But yeah, I also, when people ask me that, one of the things that I want to say is like, well, look at Kate Mann or look at all of these other women who are writing brilliantly about this topic. Go read them. I'm going to write about my thing rather than snatch a bit of material from their space.
Yeah, and I think that having that whole, many sort of voices and many perspectives, I think is really important. And one of the, th I think it's really, I think there's various strands of your work on which are interesting. I think one of the strands is about kind of, yeah, feminists not being mean to each other and like having that respect, even though you might have different points of view about things. But like fundamentally, I think we all want the same thing. So let's not kind of fall out over small things. Let's kind of read and learn and hear from each other so we can move forward.
So that's the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is building solidarity. Your book talks so beautifully about how these motherhood myths convince us that the problem is always located in the individual and that political issues are actually personal failings. And so what ends up happening is women keep running on this hamster wheel of self-improvement rather than rallying together to build solidarity with one another. And then, when they occasionally get a glimpse of how other women's lives look, they often just criticize each other so that they can feel good about themselves. How do we break this cycle? Like, how can we come together with women we maybe disagree with, women maybe we don't even like, and build some common ground for a common cause?
I think it's recognizing what we have in common. And I think it's recognizing that we all want to build a better world, not just for ourselves, but for our children and for all the children in the world. I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but I think recognizing our common humanity, recognizing the ways in which society is letting down the most vulnerable people in society, which is babies and children, and to have that as a common ground between mothers. And then I think between sort of mothers and non-mothers, I just don't think there should be any dispute at all, because again, we both suffer from good mother myths. These myths are bad for all women, whether or not you have children. So I think it's about recognizing the common ground, understanding who is the bad guy here, understanding that actually we are serving patriarchy if we have fights with other women instead of with the systems that are oppressing us. And I know that's easier said than done because we're all human and we get wound up and we get angry. But yeah, it's just trying to focus on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great advice. And yeah, I mean, I certainly get wound up and angry constantly. But I think, learning to control that to whatever extent we can has a lot of value. Alex, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you. I've so enjoyed talking to you, Zorn, and I just love your work. And I think it's great that we have this energy and this passion to make things better.
Well, I love your work. I hope everyone will buy your book. It's so good. I started highlighting in the first chapter and then I just like stopped highlighting because I would have highlighted everything. It's amazing. So go out and buy it. I will put it in my bookshop. I'll put it in the show notes. I'll put all of Alex's information there. I will be back next week with an interview with Kristen Pascucci from Birth Monopoly, and I will talk to you then.